Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
The Middleman, Disc 1, Guns of Navarone, Dubby!
I'm Sean.
I'm Mike.
I'm Julia.
And I'm Paul.
And if it's not clear what we're talking about, we're here to talk about the first four episodes of The Middleman, an ABC Family comedy that was unfairly canceled early. It's not fair.
In 2008, right?
Yes, yeah. Many years ago. But it's a very interesting show, and I suspect we're going to have a very interesting discussion about it, especially since Mike and Julia are basically like Uber fan peoples. I think that would be a fair way of describing you two in that light, yes?
I resemble that remark.
I really like the show.
Fair enough. And Paul and I think are the ones watching it cold, yes?
I've only seen episodes this week. I'd heard of it only in reference to Mike and Julia talking about it.
Fair enough. Well, since we've got two Uber fans, I think we should give one of you two the option to describe this show to people who don't know anything about The Middleman. So who would like to describe it, Mike or Julia?
I'm going to give it to Mike.
Go for it, Mike.
All right. So The Middleman started out, I believe, meant to be a TV show, didn't get picked up, and then Javier Aguello, Mark Swatch, and Les McLean created a comic book of The Middleman, which I think ran three trades and then was picked up to become a television show on ABC Family. That one created solely by Javier Grillo Mark Swatch. Grillo Mark Swatch may be known to some listeners as one of the executive producers on the first season of Lost, when it won the Emmy, I believe. And then he went on and did this show. The show I describe as Men in Black meets The Tick. It's very tongue-in-cheek, incredibly metafictional, and is described by the creator as a show for geeks by geeks. So there's a ton of pop culture references. The core premise is that this is a universe in which there is a middleman, which is a kind of a well-equipped, well-informed individual who is aware of the monsters and aliens and mutants and supervillains who attempt to bring terrible evil to the world. And the middleman often has an assistant middle person. And we join Wendy Watson, an artist who lives in an illegal sublet with her equally photogenic friend, Lacey Thornfield. Wendy is recruited to become a middle person in training, and then they go and have wacky adventures fighting comic book evil. And if you haven't noticed, it's kind of silly.
So when I was watching it, and let me know, Julia and Mike, if you think this is a fair characterization, but I kept thinking that if America did its version of a Doctor Who type show, but without time travel, this is what would happen.
I think that's not unfair. However, I love one of the things that I love about The Middleman, the fact that it is more than just the Doctor. Like, the Middleman is not the only person who matters in the show. Mm-hmm. That there's a lot of ensemble cast stuff that goes on, and I really love the ensemble cast.
That's fair. Okay. Yep. Well, why don't we then start then by talking about the first episode, an episode called The Pilot Episode Sanction. The titles for the episodes will get increasingly humorous and strange as the show goes on. So I will be telling them to you as we go. And if it's not clear from Mike's dialogue earlier when he was referring to photogenic roommate and illegal sublet, those are things that are told to us many times throughout the show, every time a scene changes. So you never forget that it's an illegal sublet and that she has a photogenic friend. So, in any case, why don't we start with general reactions on the first episode, the pilot episode, Sanction? And why don't we start with you and you, Mike, and then we'll go to Julia. So, Mike,
actually, I would rather hear from the people who haven't seen it first, if that would be okay.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Fine. We'll go first. Paul, why don't you jump in then?
Okay, I will go. I will go first. I didn't quite know what to expect when I first clicked on this on, well, the episodes on YouTube, but I wasn't quite sure. I mean, I'd heard about the middleman. You referenced it. It's like, okay, what am I going to be seeing? And then, well, when the episode starts with sight gags in the background leading to a hentai tentacle monster attacking our poor heroine right off the bat, it's like, okay, this is that kind of show. I wasn't thinking Doctor Who. I was thinking things like Men in Black. This felt a lot to me like a Men in Black episode where, because in the movie Men in Black, Jay winds up dealing with an alien right off and then gets sucked into the greater world of them. Wendy starts dealing with something happening at the job she's stepping at, and she keeps her cool just like Jay did in Men in Black, and as a result gets an invitation into this greater world. It's even more broadly comical than Men in Black. It's never really serious at all, and it was very entertaining. I mean, I kept trying to catch every geek reference they kept throwing, and I'm certain I didn't get all of them. I mean, they were just the sheer variety. I mean, hentai tentacle monster, Gorilla Grodd. It's like sleeping with the fishes. I mean, they just threw everything left, right, and center. It's like, this was really a show on TV? They got away with all this dialogue? Really? I was kind of impressed.
Yeah. I thought it was really funny as soon as the talking apes showed up. Like, it was already kind of goofy, but the second it was the apes and the one ape who mimics mafia characters. It's just like, it's the most ridiculous thing ever, but the show just kind of goes into it. It treats it as a joke to a degree, but then it just sort of like, yeah, but this is the world we live in now, which is talking super apes and evil computers and just really ridiculous dialogue, like ridiculous in a wonderful way. The dialogue throughout the show is just amazing. It's some of the best, like, reference Latin dialogue, like, ever. I didn't even catch half the references. I mean, the one time she talks to Noser and she's referencing all of the Johnny Cash songs was the only one where I was like, oh, I get every joke that's happening right now.
It took me two episodes to realize that's Noser's role, but we're talking about the first episode.
I know, yeah, but it still happens in this one. I can't remember what the exact reference in the pilot episode is. But, I mean, the pilot episode really sets the tone. It sets the tone in all kinds of ways. It tells us the kinds of characters we're dealing with, right? We have this character, Lacey, who I'm madly in love with now, who is just this dorky, a little bit dorky kind of activist / I guess almost like a PETA person, but
confrontational
better.
Spoken okay. Word artist.
Excuse
Thank
me.
Thank you, Julia.
Right, because they're both artists living in this illegal sublet. Which is fun. She's an abstract painter, our main character, Wendy Watson, right? She's an abstract painter who paints, I can't remember what she said. She said in the second episode, but whatever, it doesn't matter. But I love the characters. They're quirky, they're weird, they all have kind of their own little thing. Even the middleman I really like, because as his character develops, we see his character develop, but we get it here too that his character is not presented as the kind of figure I would typically associate with this kind of very straight-laced kind of figure. He's weirdly, he's like a liberal straight-laced guy, which was not what I expected. I really expected he would be a very conservative kind of guy because there are jokes in the episode about he doesn't use curse words at all. Like he says like gosh golly darn and that kind of stuff. And so with the expectations I had of the kind of character he would be like, oh, he'd make fun of her friend for being a hippie and those kinds of things. But he never does that. He's just straight-laced. And I love that about his character because it makes him really just unusual and so much fun for a character that otherwise probably would not have been as interesting for me. So the first episode, I love how it sets the tone for the whole show and everything we learn about the characters and the kind of just, honestly, this show's just from episode one. It's just batshit, and I love it. I mean, that's what I love about it. I really love that it's just crazy. It doesn't pull any punches here. It has a giant squid monster, and then it's got talking gorilla creatures things.
And it gets more and more crazy as it goes. And I loved the fact that, like, from the very beginning, when the middleman shows up, Wendy Watson, the way that you know that she's, like, perfect for this is that she obviously hasn't backed down from this creature. She's been trying to saw its tentacle off and get herself free and all this stuff. But eventually the middleman comes and breaks it up, and he's like, ma'am, step aside. And they both look at him like, what? And he's like, the human. And they both look at him like, what? And finally he's like, the one on the left. And Wendy steps aside. But because she's working in some sort of genetic testing lab, so the thing is human, sort mm-hmm. of.
Oh, yeah. And I love the part later on when she's having to explain to the temp agency, like, what happened, and, like, because they've accused her of burning the building down because she was playing with her dad's lighter. And apparently she's been framed. We'll get to that, I'm sure, later. And I love that she's just trying to explain to this woman, like, I didn't burn down my job. And then she just, like, gives up, and she's like, fine, a giant weird tentacle monster. They're doing all these weird experiments in the place, and it destroyed the place, and da-da-da. And the woman looks at her like she's crazy. And I love that because it's just so much fun. Like, it's just, that's how I describe this show, is it's just unabashed fun. I mean, you could tell the writers were having a blast just writing mm-hmm. this, just, it's just too much fun.
I absolutely agree. I also really love that. I love that Wendy Watson is Cuban American, and that actually, like, comes into her character. It informs her character. It's not like the be all end all of her identity at all, but it is part of it. And I love the fact that she and Lacey are really supportive best friends mm-hmm. who care about each other. And I love Noser. Noser is just fantastic.
Yeah. It is difficult for me to be objective about this show because it had such a gigantic influence on me. You know, this came out a few years before I wrote Geekomancy, and without this show, I would not have written that novel. And the middleman kind of looms large in the kind of cabinet of curiosities that is my brain in terms of stuff that I draw on.
Yeah, I just want to say, having seen these four episodes, and even just this first one, now I see where you were coming from with Geekomancy. Like, okay, this is you plugged into your brain, and you wanted to play in that sort of similar sort of space.
Yeah,
with just flipping some characters and whatnot around. Yeah, I get you even more now, Mike, having watched the show. So I thank you for getting me to watch that, because now I understand you better as a writer.
Yeah, because the lead in the Re-Reyes series is very much kind of a spiritual goddaughter of Wendy Watson, because that character just really stuck with me in the same way that, like, Buffy stuck with me. And I love that, like Julia said, that the kind of different facets of her background and of her identity all kind of matter and all add in together, but she is never only ever one of them at a time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, kind of going back to the characters, because that's interesting, Mike, because now that you say all of that, I can see that with the work of yours that I've read. It's clearly an influence, because not just because you just told me, but, you know, because it seems fairly clear. But kind of going back to the characters, I mean, to kind of parrot something that Julia was saying, you know, with the exception of Noser, who at least in these first four episodes is really kind of, I feel kind of bad saying the one note character, because he's mostly kind of like the gag of the show, with some exceptions of scenes. I did appreciate that this film, that this whole show, is, despite being kind of crazy and fun, made the characters actually rather complicated. So, I mean, we have Wendy Watson, who, you know, as Julie, you were mentioning, right? She's Cuban American, which doesn't play a huge role, but it is present. She's an artist. She is uncannily really good at handling just crazy scenarios for reasons we're not entirely sure why. Maybe she's just a genetic monster of some kind that she can just handle. No, it's just because she's just awesome. That's why. We got her friend, who Lacey, who is this activist, very passionate, but also a dork. In a later episode, we get the scenes where she just wants to watch like Italian zombie movies with Wendy as a way of kind of like what would you call that, like getting over a breakup time or something. And then of course you have the middleman, who is, you know, you would think he'd be very one note, but he's not. He has a very complex sort of view of the world. And then Ida, the android, who is just so much snarky fun. She just always has a great attitude. Well, great in the sense that she's amusing to watch. But she also has a character, despite the fact being an android, right? You'd expect that there would be less of that. But in fact, she does have a character, and it gets sort of more complicated as the show goes along. So I appreciate that all of the characters are complicated creatures, and they get more so as the show goes on. Even though there isn't kind of an overarching plot, there is kind of the hints, the whole deal with the who does the middleman work for. I mean, obviously that's what the show is trying to gear up to answer, although it at least in these four episodes we really don't get anywhere on that, because I think it's not as important as whatever crazy psycho thing they have to deal with this week. So that's, I appreciate that for the show in general, but it is something that is present here. I'm kind of rambling.
Yeah, just something love that the show. Something else that I think is notable and really came out to me in a second viewing, though some of it came out in the first, was that basically every single episode of this has a cultural ur text that it is referenced. It is kind of gesturing back toward,
right?
Or if not an ur text, a subgenre. So in pilot episode Sanction, it's very clearly gesturing toward mobster movies. So that, you know, when the ape shows up, he speaks entirely in mobster movie film quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then each episode there tends to be that ur text that it's referring back to, so that the series itself is almost an interpretive lens for viewing previous pop cultural touchstones.
That's an interesting way of looking at that.
Above and beyond the actual references, there's actual framework. I mean, I kind of got that for the third one, because it's just so obvious that I couldn't miss it. But
yeah.
But I just found out, because Ida's voice had been bothering me for the four episodes, bothering me since, like, I know this voice, and I just found out she had a cameo in the movie The Island. She was the food service clerk.
That's right, she was. Yes,
because I was just like, I know this voice. Where is this voice? And that same snarky attitude, he's like, aha! And I just found out, okay, so,
mm-hmm.
Nice.
I love Mary Pat Gleason. She's so adorable. I'm sorry, I'm being all...
Okay. So why don't we move on to the next episode, which is the Occidental Conception, which...
This has my favorite middle exclamation in it. Which, at this point, Mike opened the show with one. So we noted that the middleman does not swear, which means that he comes up with all sorts of creative exclamations to use when he is shocked by things. And if you start to pay attention, you'll notice that they're usually on topic. So in this one, where you have a terracotta warrior who's come to life, and it's all about using Earth and taming Earth, there's a point where he says, "Grapes of Wrath, Dubby."
Yep.
And I think that's my absolute favorite one, where it's just like, yes, he's really worried about the Dust Bowl coming back.
It's true.
Yeah, and the ur text in the second episode is Dune, though it's, you know, there's also references
Dune?
To...
Really?
Yeah. It's Frank Herbert Junior High School that they go to.
Oh, how did I miss that?
Oh my goodness.
And of course, he's the kind of the chosen one son who will bring about the status quo change.
Okay. I
didn't really catch that. Wow.
Sometimes the ur-text is a little bit more plot-centric than others, and I think this is an episode where it's less plot-centric.
I was focusing on all the Chinese and underworld and the Terracotta Warrior. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I didn't even see the Dune stuff. Huh.
And something that I think this show does is it will take a trope and then go a full step more ridiculous with the trope. So it's not just hyper-intelligent apes. It's hyper-intelligent mobster apes.
Right.
It's not just, like, kung fu warrior trying to, like, do something mystical. It's kung fu warrior trying to do something mystical, and he's an earth elemental. Like, there's always an and with stuff in the middleman, which I think makes it really distinct, because the characters that are deployed are always a comment on something that's already familiar, so that the work itself is metatextual on a very kind of thorough level.
So just a questioning on that, Mike, because in this particular episode, the Accidental Occidental Conception, the character who is the quote-unquote chosen one in this that the Terracotta Warrior is trying to find happens to be what we assume at first is a just an everyday white American. But then it is, of course, discovered that the wife has had an affair, I guess, when she was in China. And so by genetics, he is now the heir to the throne, the dynasty or whatever. So how does that fit into this kind of one-upmanship?
I'm not sure if that's a direct allusion to something. Something that the show does have is that the creator has, I think for every episode that aired, he's made a blog post with a complete accounting of all the pop culture references with some annotations. So if for folks who are listening and enjoying the show and you want to do the big deep dive on geekdom, you should be able to go to Javier Grillo Marx Watch's blog. It's either from his blog directly or there is the middle blog, which he maintained for a while. So you probably want to go there to get the exact reference. It is a bit disappointing that that actor does not seem to me to have been cast to be mixed race. But I didn't investigate that child actor's background, so I could definitely be missing it.
I mean, I think it's intended for us not to have thought that beforehand.
Yeah.
Because that's part of what the shock is when it's revealed that she had an affair. I think my bigger issue with it is that it's not really addressed beyond that. It's just sort of like the middleman and Wendy show up and then it's revealed, oh, she had an affair. And then it's like, well, we're not going to deal with that family anymore. Mm-hmm. Which I feel kind of is like, but you just like destroyed their family unit. Because how do you, I don't know. I felt that was, I felt like that needed to be addressed more, at least at the end of the episode, but it wasn't. This is also the episode where we're introduced to Roxy Wasserman, mm-hmm. which, if you've not watched the show, you should know that she is a reformed succubus. It's keyword on reformed, who runs a halfway house, as it were, for other reformed succubi who happen to also be working as models and other jobs related to modeling. So I thought that was really fun. Because Roxy is, you know, the moment that she shows up, I think Wendy says, like, do you want me to put a stake in her heart or something like that? Is that what she says? I can't remember exactly what she says. But she basically just suggests, like, this: she's a monster. We should kill her, right? And that's, no, this is a big deal. They're reformed succubi. So they're wonderful people now. Terrible attitudes, but, yeah.
And there's a reformed incubus amongst them.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I really love how basically she is the Meryl Streep character from The Devil Wears Prada, except that, like, the reason she is that way is because she's literally a succubus.
Yeah.
And that's also used for good. So I really enjoy her character. The first time I saw that episode, I remember kind of finding her a bit annoying at first. And on rewatching it, I just loved her. Because she's just hilarious and wonderful.
Yeah, and she has kind of protagonist-level equipping of her own.
Yes, she does. And she has depth.
Mm-hmm. This is. I also thought it was interesting that that this is the episode. Like in the first episode, it was implied, I think, that that Wendy's personal life would not in some way get involved directly in their doings because of the way the middleman talks about it. He sort of says, you know, you have to keep that separation. And that does come up again in later episodes. And I did appreciate that actually Lacey, her own sort of character, gets involved in this. Not intentionally. She doesn't know she's screwing over and possibly destroying the entire world. But her sort of activism plays a role here because she's trying to stop the use of fur in the fashion industry, and believes that if she kind of can work within Roxy's world, that she'll get access to the furs and can destroy them, inadvertently switching the special Tahiti water that they're supposed to use for like tap water, which of course results in the middleman and Wendy being unable to basically melt the terracotta warrior. Which creates a very unfortunate moment when they try and it doesn't work. So,
What I appreciate about this episode is the Wendy subplot with her father.
Yep.
In the other world, I thought that was really well done. Here she is trying to take the one in a lifetime opportunity to find out about her father, and that nearly screws over the entire plot in so doing. Poor middleman's running for his life in the Terracotta Warrior, expecting Debbie to have the water with her, and she's busy trying to find out about her dad, which just seems to have come up again and again throughout the four episodes.
It's a significant detail. I mean, it comes up again and again. Her father left when she was, or excuse me, her father disappeared.
Right. It's not only that she mentions this, she actually takes action towards the goal of trying to find out more, rather than just lamenting about it or mentioning it in background. She actually does something towards trying to do that. I mean, it nearly gets them all into hock, but I appreciate that she actually tries to resolve her own plot line in a way.
Yeah. And even as Wendy kind of remains the sidekick character, she does exert individual agency, not only in kind of sniping and snarking at the main plot, but in pursuing her own agenda.
Yeah, that's the better way of saying what I was trying to say, Mike. Thank you.
Yeah. And it's something that becomes really significant, I think, when we were off podcast, and maybe Julia will want to talk about this more, Wendy is coded as the sidekick character, but I think as the show goes on, she becomes less sidekick and more just straight up equal partner. And do you want to jump in on that, Julia?
Yeah, Wendy definitely is. She's coded as sidekick in some ways, but she's also the protagonist of the show.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like saying that in Batman, if the show were actually about Robin's life,
yeah,
then it would be a very different show.
Yeah. I think you're right. And I think it's much more interesting in a way to have Wendy too, because she's our gateway into the world, because we don't know anything about any of this stuff either. And so we learn as a process of watching her, which makes sense, I think, for this being a family show, because it provides a character that I don't know how they marketed this, but it seemed like it would have been marketed to teen girls. Would have seemed like the primary intended family audience.
Very poorly. Yeah. It was an oddball show that never really fit on the network that it was on, because I watched this live when it was on the first time. Okay. I'd heard about it somehow. I don't even remember how, but thank you to whoever directed me to it. So it was on either right before or right after a show about teenage pregnancy.
Was that the Shailene Woodley Diary of a American Teenager or whatever?
I believe, yes.
Okay.
So I don't think those shows really matched up at all. Later on, there was an ABC Family show that was Wendy Wu, like Homecoming Queen, or something that was very much like that show, where there was a bit more of a Buffy angle, and that those two kind of went together. But ABC Family was very, you know, gave them the room, but I don't know if it ever really, the show ever really fit on that network. They did do some really fun, like PSAs as advertisements for the show when it was starting.
I did see some of those. Those are amusing. Yeah. I think part of the problem is that this show's kind of an enigma. Because it's not the kind of, I mean, it's not like, I know we're making comparison to a lot of other things like Men in Black and, you know, X-Files, those kind of stuff. Like, you can make those comparisons, but those shows are kind of their own monstrosities, or, well, Men in Black's not a show, but you get the idea. Their own kind of monstrosity, which is somewhat self-contained, where this is something else, and it's sort of, it's trying to be a lot of things, and I think actually succeeds in being most of them very well. But I think that also makes it very difficult to make this show sort of work for in a network that maybe doesn't know how to market a very, very mixed, weird, bizarre show. Because this is like, I don't think I've ever seen anything else quite like this on, that isn't a cartoon with like Ren and Stimpy in it.
Yeah, I think this show would probably do a lot better if it came on in the last couple of years. Because what I feel like a show along the lines of Community would have made room for shows as weird as this. And there being more superhero shows on might have made room. As is, it was much more unlike everything else around it and didn't necessarily have a good opportunity to find its own space. But it also, you know, there are probably shows that followed that may have been taken some influence from this. So it, you know, it's hard to take totally out of its time, kind of its contextual position within geeky shows on TV.
I do agree with you. I think it probably would, if you aired this again, like in syndication on whatever, this would probably do a lot better today. But I think that has to do with the environment has changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's unfortunate that they didn't even finish the season, because this show is just delicious.
Yeah. So as we'll get to maybe toward the end, there are two additional stories in this continuity, and then a way for the comics continuity to also be very relevant. So there's a broader universe above and beyond the TV show.
Okay. All right. Well, anyone else have any last thoughts about the accidental conception?
No.
Good. All right. Well, why don't we switch to the next episode? Who would like to say the title for this one?
This is the Sino-Mexican Revelation.
It's so great. So, Mike, why don't you describe the plot of this one? Because this is probably my favorite episode.
So, yeah, this is actually the episode that I tend to show people when introducing them to The Middleman. Because I think that it is the first, the earliest possible episode where the show is really running on all, firing on all cylinders. And its ridiculous juxtaposition is especially ridiculous. So in this episode, Lacey Thornfield has gotten a job at the Booty Chest, a pirate-themed sports bar with scantily clad waitresses. And it's every time the Booty Chest is mentioned, it's that entire line in the way that The Middleman does. So Lacey has this job to pay off student loans. Wendy hears about it, and then there's a theft of an important artifact. And at the same time, Sensei Ping, basically a wuxia or kung fu movie style kung fu master, is flying in to train Wendy. And then all of these plots interconnect, and also there's a love interest for Wendy, who shows up as Wendy is trying to get to pick up Sensei Ping from the airport. And then there's wonderful stuff. And the kind of bad guys for this episode are a evil league of lucha libre wrestlers who are seeking vengeance for the death of their beloved kind of icon, El Sapo Dorado.
You forgot to mention that the thing that one of the things that gets stolen is a, I'm going to read this from the website. Teledyne water pick with a custom high output heating element and aftermarket TruPro power wash accelerator and a laser beam.
Yep.
Powered by the world's most complicated diamond.
Yep. Yes. And La Cage de Lumiere.
Yes. Yes. Yes, so you're right that it is a juxtaposition of all of these sort of crazy elements. And of course, we forgot to mention that Sensei Ping wears a Lucha Libre mask.
Which is plot relevant.
It's not just to make him weird. It also makes him weird, but yeah.
This is a slight casting spoiler, but Sensei Ping is played by Mark Dacascos, who many Americans will recognize as the chairman of the American Iron Chef.
That's
yes.
who he was!
Yes.
It's like, I know this face when they finally take it off.
That's right. So I will just say that I found this episode so much fun because it was even more crazy than the other episodes. And it just owns it. It does. It brings all of these bizarre elements together. They use this laser machine to trap Sensei Ping, and then they're going to kill him. They take him to bloody hell! They take him to
the Dread Pyramid.
To an unpronounceable.
Yes, that. Yes. They take him there. They're going to kill him as vengeance for their master. And then, of course, he takes the trial by combat in the end. And unfortunately, the middleman gets caught in it, and he has to be the one that fights off, 100 Luce Libres. And it's just crazy. And it's just so much fun. And this is, of course, also when Wendy really does sort of prove herself in a way that she hasn't really done in the previous episodes, that she just goes out of her way to rescue them and successfully, and sort of gets the approval of Sensei Ping. Yeah. It was a lot of fun to watch. I was concerned that the episode was going to make me cringe because it was playing on a lot of those tropes about, the Kung Fu masters and like Lucha Libres. And I was like, this is going to be really offensive, but I didn't feel that it was, although I can see maybe someone else might have a different opinion on that, but it didn't seem so to me. I felt like it was poking playful fun at a set of common tropes. At least I've interpreted it that way, but I don't know if others might have an opinion. Julia, did you have any thoughts on anything that we've mentioned so far?
Sure.
Sorry, I didn't mean to make it seem like... No, I just meant like we talked about a lot of stuff. I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. One of the things I really like about this one is that... So we've heard from the beginning that Wendy's father was a pilot and he disappeared in his plane. But in this episode, we actually get to see that Wendy learned something from him, and she actually gets to go and pilot the middle jet, which is pretty exciting. So when she takes action to go rescue them, it's like she does have this background of interesting skills that just randomly crop up, and it totally makes sense that she would have them. I also really like that it does poke fun at some of the stereotypes involved in different things on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's actually pretty respectful of them. So when you get into the plot of what actually happened between Sensei Ping and the Lucha Libres, it kind of all makes sense why there is this bad blood between them and what happened and what misunderstanding is there. And the way it's resolved is kind of respectful to both of the cultures as far as how things need to be resolved. So I think between all of that, it comes out all right.
Yeah. And I'm particularly fond of the way that there's kind of a back and forth with Wendy's Cuban identity in the episode, because there's a lot of Spanish spoken in the episode because of the Lucha Libre wrestlers. And Sensei Ping speaks fluent Spanish because, of course, why wouldn't he? So there's a lot of Spanish spoken with English subtitles. And then Wendy is, of course, listening and understands all of this, so she'll comment on that. And then there's a dialogue, and then she code switches into English, and it's subtitled in Spanish. There's a full kind of back and forth playfulness in this, and it lets Wendy's kind of her background as a Cuban American be an asset to her, and that she kind of gets to react to people using that identity kind of at her, and gets to kind of judo it back around at people. So for me as a non-Cuban, I felt like that used her identity fairly well.
I totally agree, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I also really like the subtitles in this whole show. Like, you have to really watch this show more than once, I think, to catch all of the little things that this show does to bring in references. And the subtitles, which you've already kind of mentioned, right? Well, the things that it tells us about locations, they're always this kind of quirky descriptions. But even as Mike, you were saying, like with the dialogue, and the switching, I mean, the moment that happened, when I first saw that and it switched to Spanish in the subtitle, and I just laughed because I was like, of course, why wouldn't it? Like, why not, right? It's already translating Spanish, which we can't, maybe like some people might, but I can't read. And so why wouldn't it translate it for the characters who aren't speaking English? Sure, why not? It works. It's crazy. Very meta. It's all good. So
Mike, do you want to say anything about the Urtext here?
Yeah, so for this, I feel like it's more a kind of culture. Like, these are subcultural Urtexts. It's the Lucha Libre tradition, you know, El Santo and Blue Devil. So it's bringing up the entire kind of superhero equivalent aspect in Lucha Libre, because that tradition is not one I know terribly well, but it's one with quite a deep history of its own. And then it's smashed up against the kind of Hong Kong action movie, not really full on wuxia, but kind of the hyper realism of ancient kung fu master. And it plays very directly with the idea of the stodgy old kung fu master. So Sensei Ping is spoken of as being quite old. Never ask about his age. There's a few rules that Wendy is given, and then she breaks all of them because it's funny. So we have Mark Dacascos, who presents as a guy, you know, very fit guy in his prime, and yet he's supposed to be old, like ancient kung fu masters are old, and he's wearing the mask, so maybe he could have been old. So it directly engages with a lot of those low-hanging fruit tropes, and then twists them or smashes them up against one another, and gives us this glorious idea of a 7-day and 7-night duel between competing masters from different traditions, and then goes into a joke where it's like they fight, and then they're fighting with Tommy guns, and then they're dog fighting, and then they're like playing Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
It's hilarious. The only thing I want to add to all this is the episode that finally got me to understand what Ozer was doing, and basically it's basically musical references. Mm-hmm. Because I got this, I bring a fire when the man comes out. Okay, so he's doing musical references. So that was what he was doing in episode 1 and 2. Okay, now I get it.
Yeah, and that his character kind of rounds out around that, and then there's even some more. There's a later episode that's very much a Noser episode.
Yes, I can't wait for that one.
Oh, good.
There's so much more to come that you guys just don't know about yet.
No, we don't.
I'm already on board, though. Like, after the first episode, I already said to myself, I really like this show, and it just kept getting better.
I'm pondering getting the DVD box set.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what this is coming down to. Like, I want this so I can put it in when, like, I'm having a bad day, and I just need to be cheered up by crazy.
Yeah, this episode is one of my kind of comfort food media episodes, along with Shindig from Firefly.
Yep, oh, Shindig's really good, yeah.
So I just, you know, put this on, and it is exactly my kind of zany, and it is soul-healing.
Yeah, I can see that. I can really see that. It's just, I don't know, I just feel like all we're going to say is how much we love this damn show, because it's so much fun. Like, I don't know when the last time I watched a show, like, maybe Sleepy Hollow. Right, the first season of Sleepy Hollow, when I was just like, this show's crazy, and that's why I love it. Like, it just doesn't care how crazy it is, it's just going to keep being crazier and crazier. And that's kind of what I feel like with this show, except that obviously this one's intended to be funny, and maybe Sleepy Hollow is somewhat less so, because it's not quite a comedy, it's still kind of dark.
Yeah, I'd say Sleepy Hollow I would classify as either a dramedy, or probably a drama with comedy, largely going off of the fish out of water element of Ichabod Crane, whereas this is a straight up comedy.
Yeah, a geeky reference Latin comedy. Yeah. And geeky in a variety of ways, which is, I mean, what Paul, you were pointing out, right? That the Noser's references are all music references.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. There's references to like movie types, like what we talked about with episode 1, where it's dealing with mafia movies, right? When they go into the ape's room, like his room's covered in posters of famous mafia movies, right?
Though they're all close analogs, because they didn't get the rights.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, everybody knows what they were doing. Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they're all of these playing on all of these different subcultures and elements. I mean, throughout these 4 episodes, and I'm assuming it keeps doing that for the whole damn show, because
yeah.
So it's just sort of, I think, like that kind of quirkiness that I just feel like this community probably would love more than any other.
Yeah. I wish that I had been involved in like SFF fandom in a more direct fashion, so that I could have led a campaign to get this show on the Hugo ballot. And maybe somebody did, and, you know, good on them for it. But yeah, it's it is way an inside baseball kind of show. But I think a lot of it can play pretty well, even if you're not kind of core genre deep geekdom or the kind of person who really likes layering references and quick patter.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I feel like there's a little bit of that for almost any audience, to some degree. I mean, like, I didn't get all the music references. I mean, I got the Johnny Cash ones, but I mean, there were others that I didn't quite get. They were still amusing, and I think that maybe if I go back through, I'll catch the ones I missed. But at the same time, it's like, well, that isn't. There are all these other things that I can attach myself to at any point in time throughout any of the episodes. So it all kind of works out. But in any case, maybe we should switch to the fourth episode.
The Manicoi Teleportation Conundrum.
So why don't we hand this one over to Julia?
Yeah.
Okay. So this episode sort of isn't as zany as the third episode, but it has a lot going for it. And there are teleportation things happening where people seem to disappear and then come back dead. And the middleman and Wendy have to go investigate this. And they find out that these people are actually aliens who like to eat gemstones and also look like they are humans who have really bad plastic surgery. So their ruse for living on Earth is that they are people who have had lots of plastic surgery. I think the thing I like the most about this is a giant spoiler, so I kind of don't want to talk about it. But suffice to say that one of the ongoing things that's been happening in The Middleman from the beginning of the show is Wendy's boyfriend has broken up with her on film and then loaded this to the social media site myfaceinatube.com and has done this because he's a film student and wants to get a lot of hits and has now been like offered some sort of giant movie deal based on having done a viral breakup video where he basically just like comes over to her house and is like, I'm breaking up with you because a film school teacher says that I don't have enough pain in my life. And so I'm showing that I have actual pain. And then Wendy punches him because really, what else are you going to do? So Lacey, meanwhile, for the first three episodes has been really worried about Wendy. We mentioned before that she wanted to get Wendy to watch Italian zombie movies. At one point, there's a wonderful part where Lacey actually says brains, brains. I want to eat brains in Italian. Because she's watched these so many times when Wendy has broken up with boyfriends in the past. And she's really worried that Wendy is not reacting to this breakup in usual breakup fashion. And by this episode, she keeps trying to get Wendy to watch this person who is basically Dr. Phil. And that becomes very plot relevant. And that's all I will say about that.
Yeah, and I think this episode is really puts the friendship between Wendy and Lacey even more center stage. You know, it kind of builds on what's been done before and tests and strains that relationship so that it's not 100% always positive. Like they criticize each other here and there, but it's as stuff escalates for Wendy, Lacey is right there. I think it's one of the series' strongest aspects that has mostly nothing to do with the weapons and gadgets and things and the comic book evil. You know, there is this strong friendship between women that underscores the entire show.
Yeah, and it's definitely, I think, one of the things that makes that friendship so great is the fact that they do have their times when they fight, and they do have times when things are strained, and they still do always come through for each other, and they obviously really care about each other. And it's really great to see that.
Yeah, and this is this is one of the episodes where Wendy's personal life really does actually impact the job to some degree.
Yeah.
At least of the ones we've watched, obviously. And I like that they brought that element out because all of this stuff is happening. Like, she has these relationships, but as you said, right, if they just stayed perfect and happy all the time, right, that doesn't really work. So the fact that Wendy keeps having to bail out Lacey after doing some demonstration and her getting arrested, right, is an issue that kind of crops up and sort of starts to boil over a little bit. And I appreciate that they bring that element in because, you know, unlike the middleman, who, as far as we can tell, has no remaining family, of any kind, right? His closest friend is the android Ida, maybe, yeah. Right? She isn't like that. She's not separated. She has family left. And so to keep that element in and not do the kind of Men in Black thing where you just have to kind of leave all that behind, I think is really, really good. My only issue with this episode is I had big issues with the Ben narrative. I didn't like it in the beginning. I had kind of hoped that like that would have been just dealt with, like they would have broken up and been over with it, and we would just all assume, yeah, he's just a giant turd, and we never have to see him again. But now I just felt really just uncomfortable with his sort of posting this breakup online and then making like getting a movie deal to make a movie version of it and all those kinds of things. And I realize that's kind of what they're going for, is like Wendy's supposed to be having a freak out because it's really screwed up. But I don't know. I felt that was really skeevy, and I just was not very comfortable with it, especially for a show that is billed as a family show. Because it just seems like that behavior, like nothing about that guy's behavior should have been reinforced. There was also the thing where like he keeps getting accused of being gay earlier in one of the early episodes, which I didn't see the point of having that there because it never really comes up later. I don't know if it does in later episodes, but I don't know. The Ben narrative was kind of the one thing that I felt like was not handled well. Mm-hmm. I felt like they could have just had it been a breakup and just had it at that. But that kind of just made me really uncomfortable, I think, for that element. So Paul wants to jump in, though.
Yeah, I just want to agree with you. Having Ben come back was kind of surprising, and it wasn't the strongest element of this episode. I kept focusing on other things because I didn't like the whole, oh, Ben's back and now he's going to make money on his breakup with Wendy. Ha 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 ha. Won't that make Wendy feel bad? I mean, it leads to good character building between Wendy and Lacey, but I didn't like Ben's use that way.
Yeah, I think I might have preferred Wendy's kind of lack of coping with the breakup to have bubbled up on its own, instead of there being that outside kind of catalyst that kind of makes her more reactive, like makes it more her on the defensive rather than her actively processing or not processing the breakup.
Sure.
Yeah.
I actually am going to be like the lone voice of dissent here and say that I really love the fact that what it takes is he's set up from the beginning to kind of be a really sleazy guy,
yeah,
who is obviously not actually very invested in this relationship and totally more interested in serving himself and his own needs. And what he wants is to become famous for film. And so, like, he's just like, yeah, whatever, I'll sell my girlfriend up the river for that. And that is exactly the kind of person who then posts that video to myfaceinatube.com.
Oh, which, yeah, for sure.
Also is like, Wendy has been so stoic about this because she mm-hmm. doesn't want to deal with it. She's got so much other stuff going on in her life. And she doesn't want to deal with it, partly, I think, because she doesn't, her pride doesn't want to take the hit that this is a guy that she invested a lot in who was actually, and everybody else could see it beforehand, because I think that's where all that he's gay stuff is coming from, is like, he's obviously not into you. What's he even doing with you? Why are you putting up with him? And she kind of doesn't want to admit that she was putting up with him, even though she shouldn't have been, because he wasn't a good boyfriend. And it takes that giant, really, really bad, wrong thing to make her break down and just be like, I can't ignore it anymore. This is horrible.
Hey, Sean, I'm curious if you caught it when I did, because this is the first time you've seen it too. Did you recognize where the aliens were all being teleported to? Did you recognize the location?
Was it the Star Trek place?
Yes, it was the Star Trek place
where Kirk fights the Gorn. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome. Like, holy crap!
It looked really familiar, but until you mentioned it just now, I honestly hadn't made the connection. But as soon as you started saying, did you recognize it? I was like, that's right, it's Star Trek.
I never got a chance to go out there when I lived in Southern California, and I regret that because it's where Kirk builds a gun and beats the Gorn. It's awesome.
And where
it is also where the sound clip that is playing in our intro music comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, the bit where she complains about the training wheels because, of course, she's holding a gun and she's going to shoot the bad guy.
Yes.
And it doesn't shoot. And this is, of course, the moment at which, like, this episode is Wendy's starting to become a middleman, but she's got a long way to go yet. And this is also the episode where he basically is initiating her, right? Like, going to quiz her on all of her stuff, if I'm recalling correctly.
Yeah.
So that's what, you're right, Julia, that's the line. That the you and your bleeping training wheels, it's bleeped out in the show, too.
Because the show bleeps out all of the profanity. And for me, it's one of the cases where using the bleep, it's actually funnier the more it happens. Like, there's going to be a point of diminishing returns, but there are clusters throughout the show where there's just, like, so much bleeping.
It's always Wendy. And it's because, like, it becomes a character thing because the middleman does not like swearing. And he calls her garbage mouth. And he's just like, what are you doing? So when it bleeps it out, it's almost like, it's not the show bleeping it out. It's the middleman's force of will of not wanting to see swear words that actively puts that black bar over her mouth and bleeps.
That's a really great way of thinking about it. Yeah.
Headcanon accepted.
So, Mike, is the Urtex for this one Back to the Future?
I think that is one of them.
I saw all the references and
then there's also like some classic SF tropes involved that are a little bit.
I mean, I think Star Trek, because as you noted, like that location is not chosen by accident.
And if you do get beamed up and beamed down again and again, true.
And the monster they're fighting is Dr. Gill.
Dr. Phil.
It was just Dr. Phil, right? Yeah. But a caricature. But he's the monster. But of course, the irony being that he's not a guy in a rubber mask fighting really slowly with Captain Kirk. He's a human being who is hunting for sport.
I like how I tried not to spoil that, and you just completely tore that down.
Yeah, because the plot here is the most dangerous game, but with aliens.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Julia. Please forgive
me. It's okay. Listeners, if you haven't seen this episode, you will still enjoy it, I promise.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it's so much about Wendy's journey throughout the episode.
Darn it, I did really ruin that.
Well,
it is kind of the big reveal at the end. Well, damn.
Yeah.
I'll put a spoiler warning somewhere.
Yeah, put a bumper in.
Yeah, it'll just be the line from Doctor Who. Spoilers. Yeah. Well, in any case, any other last things we want to talk about for this particular episode?
No, I'm good.
Okay. All right, well, we're going to keep doing these episodes. We've got basically two more Shoot the Wiz subcasts worth of this because we've got four more to watch for next month. So, but I think it's pretty obvious that we're all just basically in love with this.
I predict that you will like it even more next time.
Yeah. Let's see. There's an episode either in disc 2 or disc 3 that I think is kind of the perfect refinement of what the middleman is about, and several episodes that are even more preposterous.
Which episode is your perfect episode, Mike?
Obsolescent Cryogenic Meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the kind of the perfection of the form.
Obsolescent Cryogenic Meltdown. Okay. Yep. Don't know what that means, but as opposed to
the final episode, the palindrome reversal palindrome.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
All right, so that's your sneak peek.
Thank you, Mike. Well, perfect. Well, all right. Well, I don't think we will grade this until we get to the very end, but I just have a feeling it's going to be an A. So
A plus plus plus.
Yeah. So if you've not watched The Middleman, as far as I can tell, it's not streaming anywhere, so you do have to get the DVDs. However, I will say, having only watched four episodes, which just is the first disc, it's definitely worth owning. It really is.
I'm contemplating buying it myself now. So
I do recommend it. So thanks, Mike, for being one of the Uber fans to join us today.
Middle fan!
And Julia, obviously you're an Uber fan as well.
Yes, I am.
And thank you for bringing your joy.
I'm super happy to squee about the middleman anytime.
Excellent. And thanks, Paul, for being my fellow cold watcher.
Yep. This is a bit of levity I needed, especially this week.
Fair enough. So on that note, if you guys want to leave comments, the details are at the end of the show. So awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.